So I have a heavy burden today in a couple of ways. First, Ramin said it, I have a lot to cover. This will rather be theoretical and descriptive because I want to lay the grounds for the following speakers. So in that way, it might be a little bit boring as a presentation. That's not my fault, that's the topic. So please excuse me for that. Second of all, the second heavy burden is to open the floor. It's always difficult to open the floor. During 45 minutes, I will try to be the most interesting I can and avoid that you fall asleep. Otherwise, the other speakers will be mad at me if you don't follow well their presentation because of me. First, so three main topics I will cover today. Judicial cooperation, freezing confiscation of assets, and AML-CTF, anti-money laundering and counterterrorism financing. Before getting into the core of the subject, I always like to start with a little bit of figures to understand where we at, what's the problematic, and what's the size of the problem. And first, I would like to give statistics on criminal economy. Why? Because two of the three subjects I'm going to cover are freezing confiscation of assets and AML-CTF. These are the two faces of the same coin, which is the follow the money approach, which started in the 70s to tackle crime, to tackle acquisitive crime. Let's follow the money to try to deprive criminals from their proceeds. If we can, if we manage to do that, maybe they will stop committing crime. That was a sweet dream. And we're still on that agenda, which is increasing over the years, and which is increasing with fighting terrorism as well. We'll explain why in a few minutes. So a few statistics. As you can see, the IMF estimated in 98 that 2 to 5% of the global GDP would be the size of the black economy, so criminal proceeds. The UNODC estimated that this figure would be of 3.6% in 2009, which 2.7% of the global GDP, which is available for money laundering. What is really concerning, even more concerning, is that other statistics from the UNODC estimate that around only 0.2% of those proceeds would be actually seized and frozen and then confiscated, which means that 98.8% remain at the disposal of the criminal entities. So there's a lot to do in that area and in Europe as well, because the EU estimates that 330 billion euros will be laundered every year in the EU. That might be an underestimation. Why? Because the Ministry of Finance in Germany estimated in early 2016 that around 100 billion euros will be laundered annually in Germany alone. So we might have to look back at those figures. Obviously, these are estimations. Why? That's the black economy, that's an underground economy, so it's really hard to have concrete figures, but you can grasp a little bit the size of it. Why am I talking about the criminal economy while we're covering terrorism? There's links. There are links in at least two ways. First, terrorists commit crime to finance terrorism. We have all, I think, the example of Afghanistan, where they were growing hashish to sell the drugs and to finance terrorism. There's also counterfeiting goods, selling of arts, etc. So terrorists commit crime to finance their activities. Secondly, well, they use the same networks. The line between criminal networks and terrorism is increasingly blurry because they use the same mechanisms and same networks to channel the money. So in those two ways, these figures are interesting. Thank you, Ryan. Second, just a little bit of history to understand where that follow the money approach comes from. It comes from the US. It started in the 70s, early 70s, to fight organized crime and drugs with the Nixon and then Reagan administrations, which did both things, the freezing of confiscation, the first dispositions directed to confiscating the proceeds of crime was adopted in 1970 in the US. The first preventive measures against money laundering were adopted in 1970 in the US as well. Then the first criminalization of money laundering was in the 80s in the US as well. The influence of the US came to international institutions with the UN, and we all know that famous convention on drug trafficking of 1988 in the UN, which really started this impetus throughout the world. There was the creation of the FATF in 1990 with the 40 recommendations. In 1989, I think, the creation, and the first release of the recommendations in 1990. And then those measures were replicated at EU level and Council of Europe level, and then transposed in national law. And since then, it has always been the same influence. We have had the same thing with fighting terrorism, because it started with the declaration of the war on drugs, the war on terror, sorry, by George Bush following 9/11, with the adoption of the Patriot Act. It quickly followed with 9 special recommendations from the FATF, etc. Thank you. So the follow the money approach started, for one thing, fight criminal proceeds with confiscation of the proceeds of crime, trying to deprive criminals from their profits, and trying to identify where the money comes from. That was the criminalization of money laundering. Then it evolved, and in 2000s, there was a shift in paradigm, because with the fight against terrorism, we just reversed the mechanism, which means confiscation was directed to the proceeds of crime, money that comes from crime. The switch was that we use money to finance terrorism. So confiscation was used more extensively, to confiscate the instrumentalities of crime, the money that you use to finance terrorism. In the same way, we were not identifying only where the money comes from, but now where the money goes to. So you can see that the chain is broader than ever, and that's what we are going to focus on partly today. So, these are the topics I'm going to talk about today. I wanted to give you a panorama of EU instruments for judicial cooperation in criminal matters. I will skip that, but you have those in your slides. I can tell you already the slides are way more developed than what I will cover today, just for you when you have time to go through them. The idea here is lay the grounds, but you have more documentation than what I will cover. Briefly about those instruments, I can say there's at least a dozen of instruments for judicial cooperation at EU level in criminal matters, adopted in around 15 years. What is really interesting to note is that since the entry into force of the Lisbon Treaty, there has been a blowing up of those instruments. Why? Because the treaty gives stronger basis to develop a criminal justice area within the EU. And it keeps on coming, growing, there will be more instruments, and always increasingly towards more MLA and more MLR. So I will skip those, but you have the lists in your slides. So let's go straight to mutual legal assistance. I will touch upon that subject quite briefly, because I will focus more on prison confiscation and NML CTF. Briefly, I will touch upon three acts which are still into force today, but as you can see, I'm putting at the end of the slide, then as from 22 of May 2017, so really soon, the European Investigation Order is a 2014 directive, there's a mistake here. It will enter into force, so it will replace the three preceding instruments that we see here. So, first of all, to further mutual assistance within the EU, we have the adoption of the 2000 Convention of Mutual Assistance, which basically aims at carrying out investigative measures in other countries through a request from an issuing member state to a requested member state. Why was it important to implement such an instrument? Because the European Union has given us many advantages, amongst which the freedom of movement of capital, some persons, of products, of services, but also, and that's not an advantage but the contrary, the freedom of movement of crime. Obviously, criminals take advantage of the crossing of borders to render their repression and detection more complicated. So we had to adopt an instrument that could help improve the cooperation between member states and fulfill those difficulties within the investigation. So AIM facilitates mutual judicial assistance between authorities of the member states, be it police, customs, and courts, and of course improve the speed and efficiency of judicial cooperation. Yeah, thank you. Very quickly, the idea, like I said, is to carry out investigation matters through an authority from another member state through a request. The requested member states must comply with those formalities and procedures as specified by the requesting member states and shall execute the request as soon as possible. So that first instrument was supplemented very quickly because only 1 year after, only 1 year after a protocol was added to the convention, the rationale was, amongst other, fighting organized crime, money laundering, and financial crime in particular. So they expanded the scope of measures that could be requested from another member state, especially we think about requesting information and monitoring of bank accounts and banking transactions. Another interesting instrument with regard to mutual assistance is the 2003 framework decision on the freezing of property and evidence. This gives powers, or maybe ask member state to recognize and execute in its territory a freezing order issued by a judicial authority in another member state in the framework of criminal proceedings. So this framework decision has two prongs, I would say. First, evidence, which is interesting in this topic that I'm covering right now, and the freezing of property, which I will touch upon a little bit later on. So there are problems with that framework decision, which are the following. First, there's inadequate national implementation of the framework decision, which means that it forestalls a good cooperation. When you don't apply the same rules in the same way, there might be difficulties in cooperating perfectly. So there's first issue in that regard. Another and more pragmatic problem with that framework decision is that it's still a two-step procedure. Why? Because the freezing order shall be executed, of course, in the other country. There should be recognition of that freezing order. So that's the first step. Then, if you want the evidence, you have to follow a separate MLA for transferring the evidence. So you just still have two processes for only one thing. Oh, I want to freeze that evidence, and please get it back to me. Yeah, you have to go through two processes. So that's actually detrimental to the efficiency of the measure. So what has been the response to it and to all what I have covered until now? The adoption of the European Investigation Order, which I will touch upon briefly as well now. So it's a 2014 directive, as I have said, and a 2015. It will replace the current instruments in that regard, which I have talked about very briefly, the Mutual Legal Assistance Convention of 2000, its protocol of 2001, and amongst other framework decision of 2003, as relates to evidence. You will see that there's the other part of the 2003 framework decision as relates to freezing of property, which will be replaced if the proposal of a regulation on the matter is adopted. The proposal was introduced at the EU in December. I will talk a little bit about that later on. So, a summary of the EIO. The aim is to simplify and speed up cross-border criminal investigation in the EU. So, as you may see, the difference between the previous instruments and this one is that you have two processes in one, because it enables the judicial authorities in one EU country, so the issuing state, to request that the evidence be gathered in and transferred from the requested EU country, the executing state, to improve the speed and efficiency of the measure. And transposition deadline, I have already talked about it, 22 May 2017. So it's really soon. The biggest improvements as regards to executing instruments, as I told you, it reduces paperwork because you will have one process, a single standard form to request the help. It gives strict deadlines for the gathering of the evidence requested, and it limits the grounds for refusal that currently exist. I will skip the key aspects. I'll let you see those in your slides when you have time. Second topic. And once again, I'm sorry for going that fast, but as I have very broad, and you will see, the further I go, the more information there are. So I will have to speed up. So freezing and confiscation. First, to lay the grounds, freezing and confiscation form part as what we call today, it's trendy to talk about the asset recovery strategy. What does it mean? It means that you first have to investigate someone through a financial investigation, for instance. When you find property, you freeze that property. You also call that the seizing of property. It's a temporal restriction on the assets with a view to their confiscation or to keeping them as evidence previous to the criminal trial. Then you confiscate them as a penalty or a measure, depending on the country where the order is pronounced. It's permanent deprivation, which gives ownership of the property to the state. And then you decide how you actually recover the property and reuse the property. The focus of the EU as up to now has been on two main grounds. First, to harmonize substantive rules of confiscation. So it's always the discussion, which is kind of the hottest topic right now, of criminal confiscation per se, the standard confiscation doesn't really work. What shall we do? We adopt extended confiscation, and we're trying to adopt now non-conviction-based confiscation. I will not be really extensive on that. If you have any question, I'm happy to discuss those topics during breaks, because I'm actually finishing a PhD on asset recovery, so that's my big thing. The second, other than substantive rules, the other big area where the EU is acting is for judicial cooperation, the mutual recognition and the easing up of freezing and confiscating of assets. So today I will touch upon four things. Directive 2014, which lays grounds for substantive rules of confiscation. Framework decisions of 2003, I've really quickly talked about it as regards to evidence, freezing of evidence. Now I'll talk about freezing of property. You have the 2006 framework decision, which is regarding the recognition of confiscation of property. You have now a proposal for regulation to strengthen the mutual recognition of criminal asset freezing and confiscation orders, which was introduced, as I said, in late 2016, and which would replace the two framework decisions that you see above. And last, there's a roadmap for an appraisal of an EU framework for administrative terrorist asset freezing measures under Article 75 of the TFEU. So, substantive rules, that means the directive. As I told you, the directive is directed to harmonizing the rules of confiscation and freezing amongst EU member states. That directive has really, improved things on two grounds, extended confiscation and third-party confiscation. There was an attempt to create harmonization of rules as regards to non-conviction-based confiscation. It has, failed for the proponents of NCDC. But there's still talks about it, so we might have new evolutions as regards that topic. So the transposition of the directive was due on 4 October 2016. I have put 2015 barred. Why? Because the original version of the directive was referring to 2015, but it was a typo because countries has had 24 months to implement the directive. So these are the recitals of the directive. I will skip them right away and get into and into the core subject. You can skip that as well. This is the structure of the directive. I have put in bold what I will cover. Actually, I will not cover third party confiscation. I will just talk about non-conviction-based confiscation and extended confiscation. So first of all, Article 4.2 of the directive says that where a confiscation on the basis of final conviction is not possible, at least where such impossibility is the result of illness or absconding of the suspected or accused person, member states shall take the necessary measures to enable the confiscation of instrumentals and proceeds in cases where criminal proceedings have been initiated and could have led to criminal conviction. So very quickly, you could say it is a non-conviction-based confiscation within criminal proceedings. So when you think about, when people talk about non-conviction-based confiscation, we think about administrative or civil procedures, such as exist in the UK, in Ireland, in Italy with the preventive confiscation, etc. These are measures that are taken outside of the criminal realm through administrative or civil procedures, even though they target criminal criminal goods. This is not what we're doing here. This directive is actually creating a form of non-conviction-based confiscation, provided that we had initiated criminal proceedings. And so basically it's ineffective, because even the rest of the directive says, well, actually, if you have proceedings in absentia in your country, that is sufficient to meet that burden of Article 4.2. So even though they were trying to implement NCBC in European law, it failed here. And we will see what will be the talks about it later on and if we have improvements. But as for now, we don't have at the EU level an agreement on non-conviction-based confiscation. Like I said, it's not a true label. I will let you look at that when you go home, or when you have a break and you're really feeling lonely. I've put some interesting contributions on that subject. You can see that I have actually published in the ERA forum an article on that subject. I will go through that as well. Just one thing, there are already talks at EU level to further NCBC. There have been statements in 2013 in that regard, in 2015. More interesting, there was an impact assessment that was released in late 2016 on freezing confiscation of assets. Please note that the European Commission is going to make a feasibility study on common rules on non-conviction-based confiscation. It is due in 2017. And the European Commission is always thinking about two models, civil recovery or civil forfeiture, as we call that in common law countries, such as it exists in the UK and Ireland. And the other one is the preventive confiscation in Italy, which is a continental law model of non-conviction-based confiscation. What is really interesting in that directive is that it finally harmonizes extended confiscation, because there was already an attempt to harmonize that with the 2005 framework decision. But the issue is that the framework decision was giving three options to states to implement extended confiscation in their legislations, which is quite ineffective, because if you give different options to states, they will have different legislations, and then you don't have harmonization anymore. And that's what happened, and that led to challenges in cross-border cooperation and inefficiency in general. So the directive gives now harmonized definition of extended confiscation, and the recitals are quite useful in that regard as well. The last thing I will say about the directive, once again you have a lot of information in your slides, is that if you look at the impact assessments of 21, 12, 16, you can see that around 12 member states have implemented classical conviction-based confiscation and have aligned or are aligning themselves with the line of directive 2014, including extended confiscation and criminal non-conviction-based confiscation in cases of illness in or absconding only within the scope of criminal proceedings, as I've said. 8 member states go beyond those requirements, and more interesting, 7 member states have an asset recovery regime or where reform is ongoing, which includes also civil or administrative non-conviction-based confiscation. So you can see that trend we're going towards NCBC. We'll see where it will lead us in the following years, because there's a lot of controversy over these measures, as you may imagine. So mutual recognition, I told you already, we have the framework decision of 2003 as regards the freezing of property, the framework decision of 2006 as regards the confiscation of property. These decisions are considered insufficient, so what has been done lately, in the end of 2016 as well, a proposal for a regulation to strengthen the mutual recognition of criminal assets, freezing and confiscation of orders was released by the EU. Why is it interesting? You can look at the impact assessment, which is valuable in a lot of things, and it actually explains well the difficulties with the current framework, but I won't dig into that. I think that Luis will talk about those difficulties. So the prospective legal framework, if it is to be adopted, but if you look at recent talks, member states have welcomed actually that initiative, so I think that it will go smoothly within next year. So it was introduced in the late year to ensure that criminals who fund terrorism are deprived of their assets. It's really interesting because they kind of based their argumentation on fighting terrorism, whereas this regulation proposal covers a lot of crimes. It covers 33, I think, different crimes. Why focusing on terrorism? Because the proposal of regulation is part of a package, the package to fight terrorism, which includes, so these were three proposals that were introduced in late 2016. Proposal for this regulation, proposal for criminalizing money laundering, like a harmonization directive, and proposal for the tightening of cash flows within the EU. These are three, this is a package which results from the Action Plan 2016, which I will talk about very quickly. So even though they talk about terrorism, it's way broader than that. The improvement is, of course, that there will be only one single legal instrument for the recognition of freezing and confiscation, which is a step forward in terms of pragmaticality, and which is very interesting. That will be the first regulation of the European Union in the field of mutual recognition in criminal matters. Very quickly, the main improvements, you have a widened scope of cross-border recognition because it includes as well third-party confiscation and as well criminal non-conviction-based confiscation. So that's aligned actually with the 2014 directive. They have taken the same scope. It's based on an increased speed and efficiency of the freezing and confiscation orders. I have around 15 minutes more, that's it. Okay, I will start to speed up. And there's more rights for victims. These are the summary of discussions recently that were held on 13 January. So some member states say they would have preferred a directive. Others say they're not opposed to a regulation. So there will be talks, I think, about the form of the instruments. But other than that, member states generally welcome the proposal of the Commission and indicated that this was a good basis for discussions. So positive response as regards that proposal. Subject matter, as I told you, it includes classic confiscation-based confiscation, extended confiscation-based confiscation, third-party confiscation, and non-conviction-based confiscation within criminal proceedings. So it does not include non-conviction-based confiscation through civil or administrative procedures, which actually caused the most problems. So that will not resolve these issues of cooperation with the UK, Ireland, or Italy. So. Like I told you, as regards the offenses, it's not limited to terrorism or even serious and organized crime, because if you look at the list, of course you have terrorism, money laundering, but you also have rape, arson, racism, or sabotage. Interestingly, for confiscation, you will have a standard certificate. For freezing, you will have only a standard form. It's a simplified procedure to expedite freezing order requests. Deadlines are stricter for confiscation, 30 days, for freezing, 24 hours. Very quickly on the roadmap for administrative terrorist asset freezing, there will be other options for EU action that's going to be discussed. So I think there are now discussions over those topics, so it's a bit early to talk about it, but at least you know there are discussions on the subject. It's a new attempt because there was already a roadmap that was proposed in 2012. It didn't go through, so they're trying again. It's a result as well of the action plan 2016. And it's also linked to the failure of member states and the EU to comply with United Nations resolutions. And now, money laundering. Money laundering, terrorism financing. We have quite a few things to discuss. Once again, I will skip some things and I will send you back to the slides. So, you know that directive, the fourth AML directive, was adopted in 2015. Its transposition is due by 26th of June 2017. They wanted to anticipate the transposition deadline. They didn't do it eventually because now they're trying to adopt a fifth directive already on anti-money laundering, which is being discussed and negotiated right now. It should be done in the first half of this year. So the main interest of the fourth directive is that it creates a risk-based approach, so a holistic and cascade approach. There are some extensions of the scope. There's the inclusion of tax crimes as a predicate offense of money laundering. There's a lot of new improvements as regards beneficial ownership, which are further improved with the proposal of a fifth directive. Interestingly enough as well, within the risk-based approach, you see that there's a definition and identification of high-risk third countries, which is important. You can see that steps have been going on in that regard as well. There was the delegated regulation that was adopted in summer 2016 to define what are these high-risk countries. There are 11 of them. They tried to already change the list in late 2016 following an FATF meeting, who said, well, actually, Guyana is meeting its obligation, so we can remove it while it's improving. So the European Union tried to amend its delegated regulation to suppress Guyana. It was adopted by the European Commission in late 2016, but rejected by the European Parliament in early 2017. On what basis? The European Parliament said, basically, well, thank you for this list, but you're not actually tackling those countries which present, which help to facilitate tax crime. We think about Panama Papers and all that stuff. So the European Parliament is asking the European Commission to be more thorough on that list. So we'll see how it will go. Lots of implementation which have been made following the 2015 AML directive, the fourth AML directive, are linked to the action plan of 2016. The action plan was adopted following the Paris attacks in November 2015. It aims at two things. It aims at, obviously, improving the current legislation to fight terrorism through amending the fourth directive and through other initiatives. It aims at two things. First, prevent the movement of funds and identify terrorist funding. Second, disrupt sources of revenue for terrorist organizations. How to prevent the movement of funds and identify terrorist funding? These are key actions. Actually, these key actions are replicated in the fifth money laundering proposal. So you will see it's actually almost a copy-paste because the fifth money laundering directive is tackling those questions, one of the most interesting of which is to ensure that virtual currencies are included in the scope of money laundering, because we know that criminals and terrorists have been using virtual currencies to fund or channel their operations. how to disrupt sources of revenue through tackling terrorist financing sources such as illicit trading goods, cultural goods, and wildlife, and work with third countries to ensure a global response. I don't know if you can really see it, but this is the fact sheet of the action plan. These are all the measures that should be taken in 2016 and 2017. So you see there's a lot on the agenda. That's why my presentation is that long, because if you see that, everything that you see in red that is I have highlighted was released through instruments adopted, introduced in July 2016. What is in blue is the package that was released in late 2016. So you see how much the European institutions have been active on those fields. So there's really a piecemeal legislation and explosion of instruments with a view to fighting terrorism and other forms of crime. Those latest emerging instruments following the Action Plan 2016, proposal for a fifth AML directive, the roadmap I have talked about really quickly in October, and in December, the package I have already talked about quickly. The fifth directive was, the proposal has been motivated by two things, the Action Plan, so the terrorist attacks, but also the Panama Papers scandal. So the proposal of fifth directive tackles two questions, terrorism and transparency. Where are we now? In December 2016, there has been a fifth compromise of the Council. It's a negotiating stance. And at the Parliament level, there will be a vote of the ECOM. There should be a vote of the ECOM committee today, but it has been postponed to, I think, the 28th of February in the end. So we're still not voting it at EP level, but it's fair to say that the fifth directive will be adopted within the next month. So like I said, two objectives, preventing the financial system being used for the funding of criminal activities, so it's related to the action plan, and strengthening transparency rules is related to the Panama Papers. As I have 5 minutes to conclude, I will touch really quickly upon those. Improve checks for financial flows from high-risk third countries. Think about the list I have talked about that is changing. Enhancing powers for EU financial institutions. Very important, tackling terrorist financing risk linked to virtual currencies, and tackling risk linked to anonymous prepaid instruments. Because we realized through the Paris attacks and Brussels attacks as well, that terrorists make large use of prepaid cards. So we will be lowering the threshold from 250 euros to 150 euros and extend customer verification requirements as regards to prepaid instruments. With regard to strengthening transparency, which is linked to the Panama Papers mainly, there were a lot of improvements as regards beneficial ownership through the fourth directive. They're even furthering information transmission and gathering on beneficial ownership through the proposal of the fifth directive. And I think to conclude, the 2016 package against terrorism financing, which is obviously broader than only targeted towards terrorism, but it's part of the action plan, so that is the name. A proposal for regulation on cash controls. It's an improvement of the regulation that already exists and that was adopted in 2005. What it will bring, it will tighten cash controls on people entering or leaving the EU with 10,000 euros or more in cash. It will enable authorities to act on amounts lower than the custom declaration thresholds. It will improve exchange of information and it will extend customs check to cash and in postal parcels of rich shipments and to precious commodities. So these are the main improvements with this proposal of regulations as regards to the existing legal framework. The proposal for directive on countering money laundering by criminal law, basically they will the intent is to harmonize the definition of the crime of money laundering, which is certainly a good thing. There was already an attempt as well in October 2012, but that failed after a few months only. It was reinstalled as a project in the Action Plan 2016. The proposal was released in late 2016 as part of the package. As I said, it aims at harmonizing the criminalization of money laundering. Features minimum rules, obviously, always a minimum rules directive to remove obstacles to cross-border judicial and police cooperation and bring the EU in line with the international recommendations such as the FATF recommendations. And I think last is the proposal for regulation of the mutual recognition of freezing and confiscation orders, which I have already touched upon. I will not cover the proposal for a directive on combating terrorism. This is a proposal that was introduced in late November 2015. It was sped up by the terrorist attacks in Paris. There has been a political agreement of Council and Parliament in late 2016. The text is now under revision by lawyers and linguists before final adoption in early 2017. So there's something new as well. Very, very interesting in our scope is that this directive criminalizes terrorist financing. So that's interesting for our purposes. And last, it also defines and criminalizes the financing of traveling abroad for terrorism. Thank you.